Hello, I'm Frieda Morrison, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to this programme. We're celebrating Scots language and education in this episode. New horizons opening up, and it's time to set out the plans. Now, the Open University in Scotland and Education Scotland co-hosted what is being termed as a landmark event celebrating the passing of the Scottish Languages Bill, leading to an Act of the Scottish Parliament, and recognition of Scots as an official language on a par with Gaelic and English. So it's time to set out the plans for the future. And we're at Wigton Book Festival, hearing about the Book of Kells. And as the nation commemorates and remembers its war heroes, we have a story of a selfless act of humanity by a fleet of Chinese fishermen that saved the lives of almost 1,000 British prisoners of war. So bide with us here, Mayor, after this piece of music. This is Myra Green and Mike Vass for their album A Day a Month, and the tune, Cad Catch. Green and Mike Vass for their album A Day a Month, and the tune was called Catch. So let me introduce my companions for this episode, Bonnie Loon's Baith. In his B&B studio in Edinburgh, the money that guides us through the wiggly waves. Come in, Mr. Richard Werner. Richie, hello.
Hi, how are we doing those wiggly waves? You got to carve right through them, eh?
Oh, you got to go. You got to get
brilliant. It's a
good
voyage.
Any adventure since my last spoke on the subject?
Do you know, I've been like a wee grasshopper, Frida. I've no stopped. I've been here, there and everywhere doing things, mostly family things, but a lot of good stuff. And a lot of other stuff as well. So I've been leaning very heavily on our NHS for my dear mother. But they've been fabulous with her and getting her sorted.
I'm glad to hear that.
Taking up badminton again with my eldest daughter. That's been great fun. So what a hoot we're having. And all sorts of things, a lot of musical things as well, especially with my girls. They've got the City of Edinburgh Music School Open Day just coming up. So they're going to be performing at that. So
that's
fab stuff.
Fab, Richie. Fab. it reminds us that there is a world, a normal world somewhere.
Somewhere out there.
Somewhere. And in the rolling hills and Dumfriesshire, we will find Willie Johnson. Willie, hello.
Hello, Frieda. It's good to be back with you after a few months' absence, but I'm back.
Well, you see, we've been a wasp vegan in the kind of the kind of boot with Jim McIntosh, but we've enjoyed the sort of vegan. But yeah, it's nice to be back again. And you, Willie, you've been busy as usual, enjoying Wigton Book Festival.
I have. Yeah, it's amazing how quickly the Wigton Book Festival comes round every year. It never seems like 12 months. It was a bit of a landmark festival this year, as it was the 20th and the very last under the guiding hand of creative director Adrian Turner. Adrian's away to pastures new to a similar position at Bridport in Dorset, so best wishes to him there. I got to about a dozen events this year, As for highlights, well, there was Justin Curry of the band Delamitri on what it's like to be a musician living with Parkinson's disease. Mm. There was Fern Riddle on her contention that Queen Victoria didn't only have a passionate affair with her servant John Brown, but might actually have married him, and that they maybe had a child together.
No.
And wow. There we go. And there was former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon on her revealing memoir, Frankly, and it was a sold-out session and a very interesting one for her. I also did a couple of interviews for Scots Radio.
Uh-huh.
One we'll hear today, and the other we'll keep for another time.
For Christmas, yeah.
Yeah. Today's piece is about the most famous and ornate of all the medieval religious manuscripts. It's the Book of Kells, and a new theory that it might well have originated in the Northeast Highlands. So more on that later.
Oh, looking forward to that, mm-hmm. Willie. Right, we begin at the Storytelling Centre in Edinburgh. For about 70 participants and 29 organisations, the Our Scotland were invited for a day celebrating the Scots language in Scottish education. Now, the Scottish Languages Bill was passed on the 18th of July this year and gained royal assent by the King on the 31st of July. The programme at the centre was set out to encompass a look back at Fit Abbey that has been involved in Scots language and learning, have achieved to date, and to plan the next steps. That's important, but to plan the next steps. Fit new and far to next, embedding the language in Scottish education. Now, to launch the event, the keynote address was given by Deputy First Minister Kate Forbes, MSP, Cabinet Secretary for Economy and Gaelic, for I had the responsibility of bringing through the Scottish Languages Bill. So the Deputy First Minister started by acknowledging the work done by the Open University and its partners for helping to manage and shape the new legislation, and that the progress with the bill was made possible by the pioneering work of people throughout the land over many years. She praised the work done by partners in helping Scots gain wider visibility, especially in health and social care and social work. Now, the Deputy First Minister felt that the new law offered tremendous opportunities for Gaelic and Scots to work together to strengthen our Indigenous languages. So she was looking forward to getting what she termed her instructions as the delegates in attendance considered the actions that flowed as a result of the Scottish Languages Act. And there was a reminder, boys, there was a reminder. Mm-hmm. The Deputy First Minister reminded folk of the very tight time frames. Next year's election means work had to be done as soon as possible. Between now and March. Now and March. When Parliament gings into recess, into purdah. And she was keen to make as much progress as possible between now and then. So, the scene was set for the next part of the day and the consideration of the next steps. Writers Gerda Stevenson and Billy Kay set the next bit off in style with readings for their new books. Gerda with her new collection of short stories, Catwoman, and Billy with his love letter and Ayrshire childhood, Born in Kyle. And the gathering heard for Graham Logan, Interim Chief Executive of Education Scotland, for welcomed the opportunity to celebrate the new legislation. We heard the speakers for our sides of the community, heads of government departments, practising teachers, and in between, deliberation of the next steps. So we now have legislation that underlines respect and inclusion for Scots by law. At the end of the day, fit was the consensus of opinion, and fit are the next steps. I spoke first to Phil Lead, chair of the Scots lobbying organisation, UAVICE. Fit was his hopes for the future, based on Fitty's heard.
Well, I thought this morning was really inspirational. There was a lot of interesting points made, and there's an awful lot of good work being done out there. I thought it was really important to have Kate here this morning. Mm-hmm. I think we hear a lot from her in the Gaelic side of things, so I think it's really important to hear her voice in the context of the Scots community.
And to hear her support.
Her support.
And that leads me on to the next. Maybe we've got the hopes now. Maybe we're going to speak about the fears, because we're going to lose Kate.
Mm.
And, of course, we're going to come up straight up against a general election.
Aye. I think that was, you know, the big Takawa pints I took for the day, because it's nae long, it's basically to the end of March, and realistically, if it can be done in that time, there's definitely, I think, a gap in the Scots side of things. We nae equivalent like Borsna Gaelic, and
nothing being set up.
And food, somebody made the pint about new organisations that aren't currently funded and, mm-hmm. and stuff. There's no really mechanism
for that.
And I think that's a sign that we will need to, as different organisations come together and news about food, we can mobilise mm-hmm. around that. I thought there was also a really interesting pint for Gillian at Selmer Ostig mm-hmm. and food. Bave communities can they just learn from another but work together more collaboratively, because you always say, oh, if it could be learned from the Gaelic community, if it can they learn from us, well, let's maybe move forward together
and speak.
And that's something I'm awful passionate about, being a Gaelic learner, is more a giant platform, not just speaking about each other but moving our leads for it.
Thanks, Phil Reid. And as I mentioned, the event was set after a grand start, with writers, poets and playwrights Gerda Stevenson and Billy Kay for gave us reasons for their new books. And after the day's passing, think would they like to happen new?
OK, folks, in the background, folk are beginning to get ready to go in the rain little places. So, at the end of this day, Gerda first, future your impressions. What would you like to happen new?
Well, Mayor Scott. Awhar.
Awhar. But how do you make it happen?
The normalisation of Scots would take years. But started with the Minister, Kate Forbes, and that result a few weeks ago where Scots was finally gaining status along with Gaelic is a major start. Uh-huh. Because it's only when it's gaining status that things will follow on. So as somebody that's wrote for decades on the subject, there are these positive things happening. But a lot of money has to go where the mouths are, and we need siller to promote Scots. A wee example that hasn't been mentioned yet, the Scottish Government put up a grant for folk publishing in Scots, and that made a huge difference. When I published my book, Born in Kyle, I was all ready to do it as a Kindle publication, and it would have been solid and it would have been fine, but the fact that I got a grant to publish it for the Scots Government meant that I could bring in a great designer, etc., etc., to produce a beautiful book. And that, what a difference that made. So there are these positive things going on, but compared to Gaelic, compared to Catalan, compared to Galician, compared to a wee other leads in Europe, we're still far ahead.
I would say, as a parent of bairns with Gaelic and having been part of the Gaelic movement, that the Scots language parents need to get down on their knees and be pushing at the grassroots and not leaving it to the people at the top, because the parents or the Gaelic movement, it was the parents sticking bits of paper onto skill books that were in English because we didn't have any Gaelic resources. I've been there, 30 years sign, sticking on the bits of paper into the reading books for the bairns at the Gaelic school because there was no resources. It needs the parents to be lobbying big time.
Mm. And a bit for them that kens, them that's been educated in the subject, you haven't got that core, in inverted commas, ordinary folk that will promote Scots the way Gaelic was promoted.
Gerda, Billy, thank you. Safe journey.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Gerda Stevenson and Billy Kay. Well, as you heard, Dr. Julian Munro is principal at the Gaelic College in Skye. It is also kent as Solomer Ostig, the National Centre for Gaelic Language and Culture. Now, Julian was brought up in Macduff and speaks fluent Doric. Fit Anise, I says. So, fit does she think would be the best step forward? Julian.
Well, I think that's the job of everybody here today, is to come out with what they think would be the next steps. We've got this most amazing platform. We've got recognition, the Scots and the Scottish Languages Act. It's just gone through being signed off by the King a couple of months ago, so it's time to put our heads together and think, what do we need to do next? And we're starting for a fairly early stage, I think. We've got a lot of work to do.
A lot of work.
Gaelic, I suppose you could say, in a lot of ways, is maybe 40 years ahead in terms of the language movement. It's been, I think, so difficult for us as Scots speakers to hear that kind of recognition and to get that kind of support. But we've got it now, and we'll see what the day comes up with.
Would you suggest, this is a personal opinion yourself, that the Scots fraternity create a Scots board like they have the Gaelic board? Would that help things move along a bit faster?
I think folk need to get together, and I think we need a strategy, and I think there's maybe a role for a board in the future. But I think we've got really basic conversations to hear about what needs to go into a strategy for Scots language.
Okay, I'm going to put you in the spot. I'm sorry about that. But what do you think should go into that strategy? Just your own personal opinion. What would you like to put in that strategy?
I think we need to work out what the kind of core values would be in your strategy, what you're really trying to achieve, and you would need to work out the core areas for doing work. So one of them, for example, could be in how do you encourage Scots speaking, both by encouraging folk that have got it to use it in all kinds of places, more than we did now, and we can look at how to encourage folk to learn about Scots and to learn the Scots language, increase the number of speakers. That's got to be your kind of step number one, I think, is encourage the number of speakers.
If it occurs to me, again, I'm just sitting listening, it's how to involve the communities in it. My feelings is the bairns at school would be good at enjoying learning Scots and being part of this Scots development. But unless their mums and dads and grandfathers are ahead of them and encouraging them, it's not going to be an easy development strategy, I suppose, you can it.
Well, I suppose we've all grown up with particular experiences of being Scots speakers, and sometimes you're not even aware of who you think about. You didn't even hear the words to say it's really much of a language, but I think it is a language, and it's a way we are.
Is it why we speak?
It's a why we speak, and it's our history, our own personal histories, and the histories often of folk afore you. And it's about your sense of place. And that doesn't mean to say you can't belong to different places at the same time, but for a lot of us, there is that rootedness in community. Mm-hmm. And I think often hidden behind all this is a kind of not being sure that it's a language, not being sure that it's worth anything, not being sure if you can use it, being aware maybe that it's maybe not a language nowadays of prestige. But of course, really important part of that is to say it is a language of prestige. It's exactly where you are. It's your democratic right to express where you are and use your language. And I think we probably could do a lot more education on the history of Scotland and the language. The fact it's been the language of the monarchy, the fact that we've written phenomenal pieces of literature through the medium of Scots, going back hundreds of years. So we ought to be proud.
We ought to be telling folk about it more. And I'm going to ask something, it's nae sounding related, but it is related. But who did you become the head of Solomon Rossi being for the North East and adore it? I mean, that's a Gaelic college, isn't it?
It's a Gaelic college. Yeah. And I'm very, very, very fortunate. And one is a time I scratch my head and think, who did that happen? I'm just so blessed. I'm so blessed. And I suppose when I left the school about 1981, I got out of university and I was going to be an English teacher. And I was going to do English literature because I love books and I love language. I like French in school, Latin in school. And I could come down to Edinburgh and I thought, and I was struggling to see my language and culture represented in the main city in the country, in Scotland, in our capital. And it was a bit of an underground pursuit, really, at that time. I was interested in Scots literature, Scottish history, oral literature and popular tradition, folklore, all that kind of stuff. And I was interested in anthropology and sociology and literature and all kinds of stuff.
So you could have gone any direction?
I suppose one thing I had to do was to correct as I saw it. My language, again, it meant that quite often I hesitate. I still do it now. I think it's just something that I've developed as a habit, but you pause to change your Scots into English to survive in it.
So you just got fed up with doing that?
Well, and I wasn't just interested in my inside and the Scots side, and started to get interested in Gaelic, because it's exactly the same as Scots. It's been demoted, I suppose you could say, through the history of the country, through economic change, through colonialism, through all kinds of things. And it's got a lot of the same problems.
Mm-hmm.
Retraction and fewer speakers and folk nae hain confidence in it and nae thinking there's only future, there's no any value in it, therefore. So in a way, looking at Gaelic and looking at Scots is the same thing, the same set of problems and the same opportunities in some ways.
So,
but differences.
This is going to be cheeky, I care, but there's no in the world of that. But if we had a Scots college, like Solomon Rossix, a Gaelic college, could you jump the fence back over to Scots again and head that up? Your expertise would be invaluable. We'd get a lot of money, I think.
I'm too old, I'm afraid. There's a heap of young folk. There's a heap of really talented young folk coming through on the Scots side. It's fantastic to see, and a lot of them are here today at this conference. And we need to encourage them and use Aberdeen's expertise to work together. I think it'd be brilliant to have Scots Academy, Scots College,
mm-hmm.
in the same way as we've got that for Gaelic, and to dedicate the place to just right. encouraging you, speakers you've and growing new speakers.
You've got BBC Alba.
Did you see a lot of money there?
No, well, I thought to myself, should I say that?
Maybe I'm going to change my mind, maybe.
It's been half a fun speaking to
you. You and I.
We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
Dr. Gillian Munro, principal at the Gaelic College in Solomon Rossix. And I had to try, Willie and Richie, I had to try and see if she would jump the fence, but nah, she's sticking over there, over to the Gaelic. And, you know, you just kind of look over there with envy, but what a smashing conversation I had with Gillian. And she just puts everything in a nutshell there. Willie, what do you think? Are we getting on? We're moving on a little bit with Scots?
I think we are again. I think Scots is alive and well out in the community.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it day to day in shops and wherever you go, from the kind of Scots we're hearing in this episode, the speakers today.
Mm-hmm. And for my final delve into the contents and thoughts of the day, I turn to the organiser, Sylvia Vanica, Senior Lecturer in Languages at the Open University of Scotland, and Bruce Youngson, Scots Languages Coordinator at Education Scotland. Sylvia first. From her perspective, has the event been a success?
Yes, absolutely. I think what we've achieved today was, first of all, bringing people from 30 different organisations and institutions together. And it's been a great way to take stock of where we've got to. And we've all been inspired by how willing people were and how keen to think about the next steps and come together and really move forward together.
There's a great sense of achievement, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, if you think of how far everything's come in a short space of time, but it is a long space of time again. I keep saying that phrase, but gosh, it just feels like something's about to happen, Bruce,
yes.
isn't it?
It really does, Freda, because it should be about what's going to happen next, because it's be about the next bairns coming through. Wens, bairns, young folk that are growing up in Scotland. Everything that we do should be about what's the schooling that they're going to get, and is it going to be better? What life are they going to have biding in a Scottish society, and is it going to be better? Did we do the right thing by them? Because that's what we want. We want to be putting the language in a place where we do the right thing for the next generation.
Absolutely. Sylvia, if you had a magic wand, which I'm sure you have, and you said, okay, this is going to happen now, what would it be?
Well, I think two things that stood out for me. One is that we've really broadened out our perspectives on who are the people who want to learn and speak and use Scots across Scotland, and really make it all-inclusive and make Scots like a central part of Scottish society, like other languages as well. And I think for us, looking ahead, to really come up with a tertiary qualification
uh-huh.
that puts Scots on a par with other subject areas, and then move that into school as well would be wonderful.
That'd be wonderful. And Bruce, what's your magic wand bit?
I would love it, Frieda, that when you speak Scots, when I speak Scots, when anybody anywhere in Scotland speaks Scots, then the other person smiles and responds.
I'm smiling.
Yeah,
I'm
you're smiling,
smiling
and you.
I'm smiling.
But that's not just because you're looking at me.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you so much. And congratulations. It's been a great day.
Sylvia Vanica and Bruce Junction. And there was unanimous appreciation for this milestone event that underlined the mission of the Open University, moving the legislation to shape in policy, delving and delivering real impact. So to recap, here we go, boys, listen very carefully. This is what the steps are. To recap, and looking at the work in education, the new qualification from the Open University of Scotland is a master's module in Scots language and culture. And our 300 teachers are involved so far, with the first 29 completed. That is to embed Scots in the classroom in any subject. And it has started as a wee seed, nurtured and grown up in Banff Academy. Lovely. Now, one of the next steps that's being thought about now is an accredited master's module in Scots that teachers can study to become a teacher of Scots as a subject in schools. So one of the next steps is that specialism. So now, with the words of the Deputy First Minister still ringing in their lugs, there's nae time to hing about. The general election in March is nae far awa, and there's a lot to be done. But Willie Ritchie, fitting achievement this is to get this far. You know, the folk being sent out to the classroom for daring to speak our Indigenous language, to hear now 300 teachers learning to teach Scots in schools. What a development, Willie.
It's a major development, and it's a start.
Another page, another event, another sitting doing and discussing, I think, to come. So thank you, lads, and we leave the educational clusters for a while and turn our attention to music again. And as we come out of the Royal National Mode held in Lochaber this year, celebrating 9 great days of Gaelic culture, this is one of my favourite Gaelic singers, Kathleen McInnes, singing Oireann na Cloche, Song of the Stone, written by Donald McIntyre in 1950. To celebrate the return of the Stone of Destiny to Scotland. Now, Kathleen is with American country singer Sarah Jarosi in this track. So, Oireann na Cloche, let's hear it. Mulla min kerera kalas rinun kalavai fatsa hain na lapeng nun garalichin kas si hura va horo hiliam boha hiliam boru aikui hiliam boha si hura va horo hiliam boha ga kuda na cha chair na yo homa si ka fala his na pringats na chara ket es kala pi chas Lacha chaya yi, on your fayang as a ninen, jiving a mahili hanish and gama, see you to bahoro, hiliam boha, hiliam boru aikui, hiliam boha, see you to bahoro, hiliam boha. Milnan is a jar, nikah mahal agas ma, na flexing on nga, a feta hook is sassy, so we won't take the jar, nga a chak a clock, a hood is yet a love, it hanulad. Lodge, pull your heart in high, you lay stalling in mouth. See you to the horror, William Boha. William Boru, I give you William Boha. See you to the horror, William Boha. Bam in his chehopur, so sabbatting at the gooshke, clapping at the hoop. Tune like a mouth, a Song of the Stone, written by Donald McIntyre in 1950, as I said, to celebrate the return of the Stone of Destiny to Scotland. Right, it's Yena the Mist, maybe the most important medieval religious manuscripts in the world. The Book of Kells is a gloriously illustrated Latin text, as Willie said, with the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. It's at least 1,200 years old, but far make it, and far. Now, Willie Johnson, mech you the answers. He's been to Wigton Book Festival. Over to you, Willie.
Hi, Frieda. Well, academics have come up with a few theories over the years, but now there's a new one about the Book of Kells. The woman behind it is the Edinburgh-based historian and writer Victoria Whitworth. Now, she spoke about her decades-long passion for the Book of Kells and what she now believes about its creation.
The Book of Kells is a copy of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, in Latin, and it was written somewhere in the British Isles and Ireland, probably in the mid to late 8th century. And it's so important because it is completely unparalleled in the amount and the complexity of its illustration and the quality of that illustration.
It's called the Book of Kells because that's where it was found, but it's not thought to have originated there.
No, it was at Kells, which is in County Meath, definitely between the 11th and the 17th centuries, and since the 17th century it's been in the care of Trinity College Dublin. But before the 11th century, we don't know where it was. It could be anywhere. A manuscript is a very portable object.
There are various theories as to where it originated, one of the top contenders being Iona. But you don't think it did?
Well, Iona is in many ways an attractive candidate, partly because Kells was a daughter house of Iona. In other words, it was founded from Iona. But I am not convinced by Iona, partly because the sculpture and the one manuscript that we do know come from Iona in terms of their lettering and the way that they try to communicate very clearly and very straightforwardly is completely different from the culture and the mindset that governs the Book of Kells.
Another theory was that it's originated in Lindisfarne in Northumbria. Again, you dispute that.
Well, I do, because the Lindisfarne Gospels, which was made in the early 8th century, is, in terms of its artwork, the closest to the Book of Kells. But it's got incredibly conventional Latin, whereas the Book of Kells has absolutely crazy, playful, almost punning Latin. The scribe of the Book of Kells was quite happy to make up new bits and ascribe them to Jesus himself. So again, the mentality, the mindset that produced the Book of Kells doesn't fit with the Lindisfarne Gospels.
Okay, so your new book, The Book of Kells, throws a new candidate into the mix. You're suggesting that it actually originated, or possibly originated, in Port Mahomock, in Easter Ross. And it's a Pictish document.
Well, I do. I think it's a very exciting thought experiment, apart from anything else, because for decades and decades, the convention has been, we have no Pictish manuscripts. And I would love to go from that to the world's most famous medieval manuscript is in fact Pictish, simply to see how that feels. But quite apart from that, Port Mahomock was excavated by the University of York and has been fully published, and it was a Pictish monastery, and it flourished between around 700 and 800. And there is very, very good evidence from Port Mahomock that they were writing, carving beautiful lettering, the best lettering anywhere in the British Isles, and making vellum for manuscripts. And Port Mahomock is also at the heart of the Tarbert Peninsula landscape of exceptional Pictish sculpture, the quality of which is only matched in the pages of the Book of Kells. And whereas other people have suggested that the Book of Kells looks very Pictish, that was always dismissed because we didn't have a monastery that could be the birthplace of the Book of Kells. Port Mahomock now looks like a very, very attractive candidate. And I think it needs to be taken very seriously. I think the case for Port Mahomock is much stronger than the case for Iona.
Outline some of the evidence for me that has so convinced you.
One detail, for example, is that Pictish carvers absolutely loved taking a single line for a walk, if you like, through different kinds of decoration. So, you know, the repertoire of what's often misknown as Celtic art, insular art, consists of key pattern and spirals and interlace. And the Pictish carvers would take a single line and you can follow it, and it goes through the angles of the key pattern and then in and out the loops of the interlace and round in the spirals and then out again the other end. And this is not something that carvers do anywhere else. And in manuscripts, it's only found in the Book of Kells. And it's a real feature of the Book of Kells. So that's just one of many examples where these tiny little details of design and kind of mindset link the two together.
Why does it matter?
To be honest, the first line of my book is literally, why is the Book of Kells important? Say it's old and it's beautiful, and surely that should be enough. But it's also the most wonderful adventure, moving through it, learning about it, trying to get your head round the very, very idiosyncratic minds of it, the two men who made it. There's one scribe who's also an artist, and then there's another artist who's working in collaboration with him. And they both have the most wonderful, curious, inventive attitude towards art and text and the interrelationship between the two. And the word that comes to mind when I think about their work is the Italian word sprezzatura. I don't know if you know this, but it's this wonderful Italian word for when you're absolutely chic to the last possible degree, and then you ruffle up your hair because you don't want to look that perfect. It's just that kind of devil-may-care attitude that imbues the Book of Kells. And I think any artwork that is so exciting and rewarding to study is definitely earning its keep.
The Book of Kells has been a 30-year passion, obsession for you. Is this you putting it to bed?
Never. Never, never, never. I mean, what I would really like to do would be a different sort of book that was like a translation and a commentary on every single page, because every single page has got something extraordinary going on. There's only one page of the whole manuscript which is not decorated in any way at all. And in fact, I think that's done on purpose as well, but you'll have to buy the book to find out why.
Absolutely fascinating. That was Victoria Whitworth, who expands her Port Mahomock theory in her new book called The Book of Kells, Unlocking the Enigma. It's published by Bloomsbury Publishing.
Well, hey, The Book of Kells is a Pictish document. Wow!
Victoria puts forward a fairly convincing argument, I have to say. And yeah, absolutely, it is really interesting. But it doesn't matter where it originated. If you look at the pages of the Book of Kells, and I've seen pictures of them, they are stunning. And to think that somebody, there were people 1,200 years ago capable of doing that kind of work is just astounding, really.
I like that phrase, the Italian phrase about, you know, not looking perfect. That's us. That's me.
I had to laugh at that. That was wonderful.
That's a good one. We'll need to adopt that for our mascot. If we ever get badges made, we'll have that printed on it. Not perfect. Never looking perfect.
Just ruffle my hair.
Just ruffle my hair. Thank you, Willie. That was lovely. Right. Mere music. Well, I was out in the stubble parks yesterday watching the geese land Aruma. This is Jim Reid with a poem for Violet Jacob. He turned into a song. This is The Wild Geese.
Oh, tell me if it was on your road, your roaring norland wind, as you come blawing frae the land that's never frae my mind. My feet, they travel England, but I'm dying for the north. My man, I saw the siller tides run up the Firth of Forth. Oh, tell me if it was on your road, the roaring Norland wind, as ye come blowing frae the land that's never frae my mind. My feet they travel England, but I'm dying for the north. My man, I saw the siller tides run up the firth o' forth. I wind a kennem wheel and youch, and find the fallen rise, and fain I'd feel the creeping mist on yonder shore that lies. But tell me as ye pass them by, but saw ye on the way, my man a rock the roving gulls that sail up in the tay. But saw ye Nathan Lee and wind afore ye come to Fife, for there's muckle lie in yon to tay that's mair to me nor life. My man has swept the youngest braes that ye have na trod for years. O wind, forgie a hameless loon that canna see for tears. And far abin the youngest straths, I saw the wild geese flee. A langman's keen o' beaten wings with their heads toward the sea, and aye their crying voices trailed a hint among the air. O wind, hae mercy, had ye'er wished for a darna listen mair.
Oh, what can I say? Through the poem by Violet Jacob, The Wild Geese, sung and put into a song by the late Jim Reid. Richie, you and I were talking about that. That's one of my favourite versions. That's from my archive. You'd never heard that version.
That's a new one. Yeah, I actually recorded a version with Jim when I was but a loon at Pure Hill Studios way back. And that was his last album that he made. But I've not heard this one before, and it's brilliant. Beauty. Markedly different as well. Kim.
Yeah, agreed. Right, this month, throughout the land, the nation remembers its war heroes. So many selfless acts of humanity. And one of these acts is being commemorated and celebrated 83 years later. Willie, tell us more.
Frieda, this particular act of humanity, and no little bravery, I should say, was by a sampan fleet of Chinese fishermen who saved the lives of nearly 1,000 British prisoners of war way back in 1942. Now, quite rightly, if a bit belatedly, it has been commemorated all these years on. What these fishermen did, they either rescued directly or they prevented the execution of men who survived the torpedoing and the sinking of the Lisbon Maru, which was taking them to incarceration in Japan. One of the survivors was Dundee-born James Gow, who went on to live his post-war life and raise his family in Dumfriesshire. His son, Ian Gow, told me about his father's remarkable escape from the ship that could well have been his tomb.
The Lisbon Maru was what they called a hell ship. It was basically a merchant ship that was being stuffed full of Allied prisoners being ferried from one prison camp to another one.
How many were on board?
There was just over 1,800. I think the actual official figure is something like 1,816 on board the ship. Yeah.
Being transported in what kind of conditions?
Well, one of the former prisoners who died recently was saying, if you can imagine what hell was like, it would be like the hold of the Lisbon Maru. There was actually three holds. The hold that my dad was in, hold number two, had probably 600-700 in it, so it was dark, it was claustrophobic, there wasn't really much in terms of airflow. They were in various sort of stratified layers, if you like. He was in the Royal Scots. The Royal Scots were in the bottom half of the hold. The Middlesex Regiment was in the top half. They were on these sort of slatted partitions. And you can imagine what state the prisoners were in after, well, this was 1942, so that's the best part of a year, being malnourished. A lot of them would have diseases like dysentery, diphtheria. Some would be sitting in the bottom on the sand, which is there as ballast. So they'd be surrounded by all sorts of things like human excrement, urine, vomit, disease, etc. The conditions would be oppressive. As I said, they'd be airless. It'd be hot in there as well because they were sealed in. The holds were, the hatches were battened down unless they were out getting a little bit of exercise or going to the latrines or whatever. Then they were sealed in for the duration that that they were there. So it'd be atrocious.
And then an American submarine in the vicinity didn't realise what the purpose of that ship was because it was unmarked and loosed off three or four torpedoes, one of which hit. What happened then?
Yeah, and sadly, this was a common case with the hell ships, as they were called, that they were valid targets as far as the Allies saw. And to be fair, none of the survivors had any bad words to say about the crews of these submarines. They said they were just doing their job in the time of war. They were trying to sink merchant ships that they thought were actually contributing to the war effort for the Imperial Japanese Army and the rest of the military. So the torpedoes were fired. I think most of them missed. One hit the ship. The ship shuddered to a halt, and the things started to go wrong. There was panic amongst the Japanese army. There were lots of running around, lots of shouting. The holds were battened down again, made more secure. The lights started going off. So they knew they'd been hit by a torpedo. So they knew it wasn't going to go well from there on.
The prisoners managed eventually to fight their way out of the hold that they were trapped in. Mm. Your dad went overboard eventually as a non-swimmer. How did he survive?
Well, like a lot of people, I think it was really by luck, the amount of luck that was involved in people getting out of the ship alive and then surviving beyond that is incredible. He basically clung to a plank, a piece of driftwood or something, and just clung onto that. And he did. See, he often looked back sort of ruefully, I suppose, in some way, that he was saying that he couldn't swim a stroke yet. There was other people, strong swimmers, that were making out towards the nearby islands. They would either get swept away or they'd be so exhausted that they would maybe just sink. Or if they even made it to the islands, they could get washed against the rocks and dashed to their death, sadly.
And some were being shot as well by the Japanese soldiers in the water.
Absolutely. The Imperial Japanese Army were going around shooting at the prisoners. They were driving motorboats over them, killing them that way. One of the sort of callous things they were doing was that if a prisoner actually managed to make it successfully to one of these launches, the motor launches, then they might try and start to clamber up on the netting. And then they'd get either shot or kicked back into the water or get a rifle butt in the head. So it was fairly clear initially that there was no intent from the Imperial Japanese Army to rescue any of the prisoners who were escaping from the sinking ship.
But then the Chinese fishermen arrived. And tell me about that.
It's something that's actually still celebrated, quite rightly so, in the islands, that it's an act of humanity against overwhelming odds, just about, because there was these fishermen who, they're not the wealthiest people. They had seen this was happening. They'd seen a wreck. They'd seen that there was flotsam floating about. They thought, well, maybe that cotton and that bale of clothes might come in handy. But then they started seeing there was people out there. So that's when they started pulling these people out of the water. They had no idea who they were. They couldn't speak English. The prisoners couldn't speak Chinese. But they were helping them because they were human beings in trouble. And of course, once the Imperial Japanese Army saw that there were witnesses and there were people actually being rescued and they would be around to tell the tale of what actually happened, that's when the Imperial Japanese Army and the Navy started actually rescuing the prisoners. And I don't think I can emphasise enough what a brave act it was of the fishermen, because they were risking their lives. It's not uncommon for reprisals to be taken against people who are aiding the enemy, if you like. So they could have lost their lives, but their whole families could have lost their lives. Their whole villages and communities could have been razed in revenge and retribution by the Imperial Japanese Army. But they were willing to risk all that to save these fellow human beings, which was very touching.
Over 80 years on, that act has now been commemorated with the dedication of a memorial on the island closest to where the Lisbon Maru went down, and you were there.
Yes, I felt very fortunate, very privileged to be one of a small number of relatives and descendants who were invited to attend the dedication of this ceremony to the bravery and the humanity of the fishermen in rescuing. They directly rescued about 340 of the 900 or so prisoners of war who survived the sinking. But if it hadn't been for them, then the others would have been killed almost certainly. So they didn't just directly rescue the 340, they rescued the whole sort of 900 of the cohort. So I felt very privileged to be able to go along and celebrate, if you like, in a way their heroism and their basic humanity, that when the chips are down, when things are tough, then human beings will come round and actually get round to helping each other, even in the face of adversity.
Your dad didn't speak much about what happened to you. You would imagine he'd be very satisfied, gratified that what they went through is now being remembered.
I think, yes, in a way, I think he would. I think he would probably have been gratified that his comrades, his muckers that he lost, are getting remembered and they haven't been forgotten. Because I think he, although he's never talked about it, I think he often thought about them. I think he would have been, as they say, gratified in a way that it hadn't been forgotten and what they'd gone through hadn't been forgotten and what they suffered hadn't been forgotten, or the humanity of the Chinese fishermen who essentially saved all the ones who made it.
That was Ian Gow talking to me about the story of his dad, James Gow, and the story of the Lisbon Maru, an incredible tale.
Well, what, as you say, an incredible tale. And I mean, Richie and I were talking about this earlier on, and there are tales, there are stories we've had in this programme, but this tale, this story, just takes your breath away, what these people went through.
Yeah, and for so long it was largely unknown. As I say, that, you know, the war in the Far East never quite got the attention here as the war on the Western Front. You know, we celebrate VE Day much more than VJ Day. And I know that this rankled at Ian for a long time. Ian and I are contemporaries. We were actually at school together. And it's only in relatively recent years that I became aware of the Lisbon Maru and his attempts to try and get more recognition for it. And to be fair, now it's happening. I mean, apart from the memorial, the monument in China that he was privileged to attend the unveiling of, there has been a recent documentary and a recent feature film about it as well. So, you know, it's now becoming known, and it deserves to become known.
Deserves to become, absolutely, lest we forget, is the phrase that comes to mind. And the hell that these folk went through. Thank you very much for taking that to let us hear. Best wishes to Ian. Thank you, Willie, and that takes us to the end of this episode. My thanks to the organisers of the education gathering. We heard from earlier on, and mere power to their plans for schools. And just a note, the Elphinstone Institute at Aberdeen University is staging a unique and wonderful Button Boxes and Mooses Festival on the 14th and 16th of November. So for more information and to book tickets, visit www.buttonboxesandmooses.com or visit their ticket shop. Celebrating Smar Reed Instruments, congratulations to the director who put this together for the Elphinstone team, Frances Wilkinson, herself a superb concertina player. And the programme looks fascinating and brilliant. Well done, Frances. So we finish with another maestro, with the maestro that is Duncan Chisholm for the album Sandwood, A Track Card Islands on the Edge. And thank you for being with us. Keep well and warm. Join us again, and thank you for listening. For Willie Johnson, Richie Werner and myself, Frieda Morrison, enjoy your space.